Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing. It can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates.
Greetings. You're with me backstage at Guildford's G Live venue on what is the, 9th, is that right? No, I think it might be the 10th actually, date of the tour. Hold on, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Oh no, it's the 11th. I don't know what's going on. It's been going really well. If you've come to see us on this tour, thank you. What a joy. It's been absolutely delightful. And I'm so thrilled with the reaction. And it's funny with this tour. I didn't know exactly what it was going to look like or necessarily even what songs I wanted to sing when I had the idea to do a Christmas tour. But one thing I did know is how I wanted people to feel when they experienced it. And I just wanted to bring some sort of properly festive cheer and a bit of fun. And I've had some really, really lovely comments back that people seem to be receiving that feeling. So that has made me feel really happy. And sorry if you can hear the sound of Sharpie. It's because while I'm talking to you, I am signing programs. That's me slapping them on the floor. I've got these beautiful programs we've done. And yeah, it's been really good fun. We had our London show a couple of nights ago, had all the kids come out on stage, had all my family and friends there, and that went well. And that's always a relief, to be honest with you, because London shows are a mixture of emotions. They're like, they're my hometown. So I always want, you know, a good result, but also you're like, ah, because you walk out and it's like, bloody, where's Wally? Seeing all my friends and family everywhere. But you want everybody to, you know, see what you're up to and enjoy it. So it's just, yeah, it's really nice. It went well. And I'm sure Guildford tonight will be no different. It's been really good. It's been lovely and brilliant. You know, mostly sold out shows. How nice is that? Lucky me. And yes, anyway, so you probably don't want to hear about all that. Maybe you do, I don't know. this week's podcast guest. So I'm trying to remember what first introduced me to Sandra Igwe. I think it might have been I was reading online about Vogue. They did a dinner for influential women, and one of them was this woman, Sandra Igwe. I started reading the little caption about her, and it was talking about how she has formed a group called the Motherhood Group, which has a focus on Black women in pre- and postnatal care, because quite startlingly, Black women are 4 times more likely than white women to die during pregnancy and childbirth. And I remember hearing that statistic when I spoke ages ago to Candice Brathwaite, who was one of the guests I had on my first series of the podcast. And Candice had a book called I'm Not Your Baby Mother, and she spoke about this statistic in that book. And Sandra has a book called My Black Motherhood, and it details how she found her first and her second birth. She's got 2 little girls, really traumatic. She felt she wasn't listened to properly. She felt that she was her emotions were dismissed by the midwife. She felt she had to justify herself, her position, her grounding, just to get some respect. She fundamentally just felt she wasn't receiving the same level of care as she should, or that there was much kindness attached to it, which really is so startling, isn't it? Because, look, when you're going through childbirth, you feel very vulnerable, you feel out of control, and the last thing that you want to have is feeling like people aren't listening to you properly. So what is rather magnificent about Sandra is she didn't just think, oh, well, that was a traumatic experience, on with the rest of my life. She, somewhere in her, felt this little flame of, I don't think that's good enough. And anecdotally, she was hearing similar stories from other people that she knew, other black mothers. She started a WhatsApp group that grew and it grew. And now it's a massive organization. And she campaigns to make change, to make a legacy that will hopefully shift this bias for her daughters. So a really, really impressive woman, and wishing her well as well, because she's about to have her third baby, I think pretty much any day now. She's had the baby shower, and I think one of her last posters said something like, just waiting for you to arrive now. So I hope she's doing okay out there, and I hope that her next childbirth experience is a more positive one. But yeah, what a woman, and I'm all for making that change. I think, as I said before, the idea of not being listened to is just, it's so traumatic and it's so fundamental. So anyway, over to Sandra, my chat. I'll be here continuing my signing, and I will speak to you on the other side. All right, see you in a bit. Sandra, it's so nice to meet you, and thank you for talking to me today. I think we're going to have a really interesting conversation, and I'd like to start with the here and now, because you're about to have baby number three. How are you
number
feeling?
Number three.
Are you feeling good?
I'm feeling excited. I'm feeling nervous. I'm really, really, you know, apprehensive also about my pregnancy, the later stage. That's where I had previous complications with my first two, but for the most part, I do feel like this is a blessing, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's an exciting feeling. I remember that feeling where you're just like, I know I'm about to meet this new person and they're going to change everything, but I don't know who the person is yet.
That, yes, exactly, exactly. So I'm just looking at names at the moment, and so just trying to see if it will fit in with my Zoe and my Chloe.
Because
so far, their names rhymes. Yeah, yeah. So looking at rhyming names.
Well, that's the thing. You don't realise when you have your first that you've already set up a little pattern of names that need to go. And you've made life quite, well, it's quite sort of prescriptive for yourself by having them rhyming names. So that really narrows it down.
It really does. And there's not that many names, sadly, that end in O-E.
You'll find it
yeah,
for whoever it is. So I suppose it's very prudent actually that we're speaking at this time when you are approaching another birth, because your associations, I speak to women who've, you know, their careers have fallen in all different paths. Some women are doing what they do, they have a baby, they go back to doing exactly the same job as before. For other women, having their baby changes everything. And I suspect that is exactly the category that you're into. So why don't we go back in time to what was going on in your life? What were you doing when you were having your first baby? What was your job before your baby?
Wow. So 7.5 years ago, almost 8 years ago, when I was pregnant with my first daughter, I just met my, about a year before, met my partner, my now husband, and I was, you know, just finished my MBA working in the University of Coventry when I moved up to Coventry. But prior to that, I was actually in the University of Hertfordshire doing their contract. So I had experience in, you know, collaborating with small enterprises to big enterprises and the university. So doing their contracts with my legal background, was very, very ambitious, traveling the world, going out to eat. And I really, really enjoyed life. And that's probably why during my pregnancy, it was a massive shock. So Zoe wasn't planned. And I know there is some, taboo around, I guess, unplanned pregnancies and how you manage that. But that was a massive shock for me, something that I didn't have in the pipeline or could foresee for at least another 5, maybe 7 years. So for me, things had to dramatically shift. And that's probably why I struggled a lot with adjusting, and also my mental health as well at the time. So, yeah.
Well, no taboo in my house. My eldest, I don't know if he minds knowing, I have told him no, but that wasn't a planned baby. Definitely a wanted baby, but yeah. I'd only been dating Richard for about 6 weeks when we found out we were having a baby, which was, when people ask me if I planned it, I'm like, whoa, you must credit me with some intensity in the early stages of a relationship. Like, oh, I think this is going to work. Let's have a baby. So I think that kind of, a bit like you, and, you know, my own smaller way with the podcast, it put into motion this whole chain of events where I really had to think a lot about my sense of self, what I wanted for myself, and how on earth I was going to find my way back to me now that I was also somebody's mum. And there's lots about motherhood that causes you to hold a little bit of a mirror up to yourself about your own upbringing, your relationship with your parents, what kind of a parent you want to be yourself, where your values are at, what's important to you. But I think also, if you have a pregnancy or a birth that throws you into something that's quite traumatic and unexpected, that is something that takes a while to get over. And sometimes those conversations don't have for quite a long time afterwards because everybody's too busy saying, oh, congratulations, your baby's here. So you're supposed to sort of just shut that chapter a little bit, like that's just what happened before, and now you get on with the here and now. So I'd love to hear from you a little bit more about what happened when you had your baby that kind of slightly sparked everything that's gone on since then, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for being so honest, Sophie, by the way. That really helps me to open up a lot more easier. And as I mentioned, I probably was the first in my circle of friends to have a baby, to become pregnant, and also to get married as well. So there was quite a bit of pressure in having to sort of have this joyful, graceful, blessed experience and really show the highlights of motherhood, of pregnancy. But, you know, I guess for me, what happens when, you know, you try your best to reach out for support, you try your best to be honest, and you're fearful that actually you might have a lot of judgment, you might, you know, be looked at funny because actually, Sandra, wasn't your life supposed to be perfect? And there's this perception that motherhood is supposed to be, you know, blissful and smooth and sailing, especially for women from my community, you know, Black, ethnic minorities, we're so used to being labelled as the strong Black independent woman that when we do find ourselves, you know, really struggling, adjusting, the sleepless nights, the anxieties, not trying to be stereotyped, that we don't actually get the help that we need. And so for me, I found that the early days of motherhood were quite isolating, even though I had friends, I had people who, you know, were supportive. I couldn't really show my full mask, and I couldn't really show my full vulnerability in that sense. And then especially, you know, going through the maternity system as a fairly young looking Black mother who was navigating her way through being a mother for the first time, as well as not really understanding, you know, some of the other challenges that encompass being a mother, being pregnant, and also then being a Black mother, where on the receiving end of so many harmful stereotypes, as well as like really poorer outcomes. So I didn't get pain relief in my pregnancy, in my labor. I begged and pleaded for, you know, for them to check me. They sent me home 5 times. They told me that I was exaggerating my pain. My baby's heart rate dropped. They told me that I was over screaming, and all of these horrible feelings I felt during that period, that when I did struggle with my mental health after giving birth, I promised myself I was never going back to a place or a system that harmed me in my pregnancy and in my labor. And so I essentially just struggled and suffered in silence, really. I didn't tell anybody, and I made sure that my house was prim and proper and clean, so that when the health visitor came to visit me and my baby, my new baby, I didn't look like I was struggling, especially because of the early interactions as well, which I might go into as we like progress with this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, there's some things you're saying that massively resonate with me and my experience, actually. I was the same as you. I was the first out of all my friends and, you know, my family to have a baby. So none of my girlfriends had a baby. And whilst they were really supportive, I'd suddenly found myself with my priorities shifting and my brain somewhere else. And so I felt like I felt isolated. I felt like there were aspects of just being able to sort of try, and I wasn't really in the same place as them anymore. If we were meeting for, you know, those rare nights where you just like, okay, I'm going to get a babysitter, or, you know, Richard's going to have the baby and I'm going to go out and meet them for dinner. If they were running like 15 minutes late, 20, I was like, okay, I missed bath time and you're not here. I missed bedtime. You know, I could have read one more book. Little things like that. And I remember I didn't have any girlfriends with the babies. I didn't. I missed the last bit of my pregnancy, so I didn't get any of the sort of NCT community, you know, knowing other young mums nearby, new mums nearby, I should say. And I just found it really lonely, a lot of it. But that's without me feeling those extraneous pressures or judgments about how I should be coping or how open I can be and how vulnerable I can be. I didn't experience that. So hearing you say it makes me think, I know what pressure is there without all that, let alone with that thrown in there on top. And it's interesting because until I was reading your book, I think, I mean, there's a lot that's endemic in our culture that you don't really question until someone actually points it out. And things like the trope of the strong black woman is so, you know, it's so present. And of course, the casual reaction to it is, well, that's a very positive image. It's being seen as being strong is, well, isn't that a great thing? Sure, but as we now know in modern parenting, we encourage our kids to see vulnerability and being open about the things you find hard as being part of your strength. But if you're just a strong person, then showing those chinks, firstly, it's undefined how that might manifest, but also it doesn't really allow them to be there in the first place. So I guess... And I guess at the time with your new baby, you're not even really able to forming the thoughts in that way. You're just feeling one way on the inside and then trying to present differently on the outside. But as I gather it, you were also subject to what is, you know, it's called like microaggressions, interactions with healthcare providers who didn't know how to speak to you and undermined your voice.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you touched on, you know, how it's perceived as a wonderful thing to be strong. And I definitely encourage, you know, people to find beauty in resilience. But, you know, for many women, women like myself, we don't have a choice but to be strong, even when we want to have, you know, be on the receiving end of care, respect, empathy, and vulnerability as well. And we've glamorized, you know, the strength of women, the strong black independent woman trope, but actually it's very harmful, especially in a healthcare setting or a maternity care setting where actually, for example, black women are the least likely to get pain relief when asking for it. That in itself has its knock-on effect. Black women are the least likely to get support for postnatal depression or follow-up treatment. Again, that links into us. I've also perceiving ourselves as strong as well, that we could bear everything and we don't need help or we don't need support. In fact, when I first told or tried to share with my mom how I was feeling, she's a typical Nigerian Igbo woman who's gone through so much, bless her. She's had 4 children by herself as a single mother. She came from Nigeria all the way to England many, many years ago and had to start from scratch. So when I told her that I didn't feel like myself, or I was feeling low, I was feeling anxious, or I couldn't get out of bed, she would say, "Sandra, why are you crying?" You know, in her thick accent, like, "What? Like, you have an amazing life. Like, what I had to go through, what she had to go through, sorry, was 10 times harder. You should be grateful. You should get on with it." And so even that guilt of, okay, am I complaining? It's true. Our aunties, our mothers, our grandparents had it a lot harder than us. What are we complaining about? Especially, you know, I had a supportive partner. We had a roof over our head. We had income. But the thing is, with you know, Sophie, that with mental ill health, with depression, with anxiety, with low mood, with pregnancy, you know, those circumstances it helps. But again, a lot of the feelings are inexplainable. You can't really explain why you're feeling the way you're feeling, even with, you know, a healthy baby, a roof over your head, a supportive partner, you know, and, you know, finances in place. Those voices that come into your head telling you you're not good enough or that you need to try harder, sometimes they can't be silenced. And that's where I fell into is, you know, feeling like, okay, I can't reach out to, you know, professional services because actually they've harmed me in my, you know, my labor experience. And I don't feel like they, you know, actually want to give me that care and support that I really want. And then also I can't go to my community because they will say that I'm complaining. And also there's a heavy stigma around mental ill health. Growing up, I always thought that somebody who was depressed or had mental health challenges, for example, was that crazy person running on the street butt naked. That was obviously very ignorant of me, but that's not the case. You know, it can be the person smiling. It can be the person laughing. It can be that person who had their home put together like myself. And that's where, you know, we need to, as a community, speak up, share that we are struggling, and also want, like, speak together on how we can find practical solutions of supporting or providing that support, sharing our own lived experience as well.
Definitely.
So I had to work a lot around the stigma and the shame and the judgment that came with vocalizing my needs and trying to pursue help. So yeah,
and I think you're right that we're much better at recognizing that the people feeling the worst on the inside might be the ones who are, you know, there and outwardly looking great. And I spoke to a woman not very long ago who had postpartum psychosis. And she spoke a lot about this time when she went out for dinner and she had, like, bright lipstick on and did a smiley picture with a glass of champagne, like, first night out with my husband post-baby. She said, this picture does not tell you what I was feeling the inside. You cannot judge it from this picture. This is what, you know, it's not always obvious. It doesn't always present like you think. And also you can, I mean, obviously that's a very extreme thing, but I think with a new baby and all the hormones, it's possible to feel lots of different things simultaneously. So you can be feeling, as you say, you know, grateful and excited and blessed about your new baby, but also all the feelings of dread and the pressure of the responsibility and all of that stuff simultaneously. And I think that thing about your mum, it's very well-meaning, isn't it? And people say, look, there could be this, that, and the other happening. Of course. But just because other things could be so much worse, it doesn't mean that it's not okay to be feeling like you're not coping. I think we recognise that quicker now, but some of these things are still catching up now in, you know, 2023, where we're at. You know, we're still getting there, aren't we, with a lot of the conversations around mental health. It's definitely come on a lot since I was first a mum. That's nearly 20 years ago now.
Yeah, oh, wow. So
yeah, it's definitely a better situation than it was then.
But, absolutely.
And so, when was it that you started the WhatsApp group for the motherhood group?
Yeah, so after going through such a horrifying birthing experience and then, you know, being handed like leaflets and flyers to go to this play group and this stay and play area, and I tried to go to one or two, so I really did. When I went there, actually, it made my issues feel a lot heightened. Many of the times I was the only young and or black mother in the space. And so I felt, you know, not really welcomed, not really included. And also I forgot things like my, like, nappy wipes and things like that. And it made me feel a lot.
So anxious.
Yeah, it made me feel so anxious. Yeah. I thought, you know what, I'm not going out. There's no point. I'm going to stay at home and I'm just going to talk to some people online and see where that gets me. And out of that, I think that was probably about 6 months after giving birth. You know, we had a WhatsApp group and it kind of spiraled out of control. So we had, you know, just like three of us and people would add their mum friends and their mum friends. And then suddenly we had over 100 mums in the chat speaking about things that, you know, really mattered to us at the time. Like, how do we balance, you know, new motherhood and our relationships? How do we, you know, confide in family about the way we're feeling? What can we eat, you know, and things like that. Things that services weren't really understanding or really bringing to the forefront. Again, there's so many different, like, cultural nuances and practices that a British-born Nigerian woman has. So, for example, like, my mum always told me, make sure the moment your child is born, you give them water. And then my nurse would say, never give your child water until they're at least, you know, is it 6 or 8 months or something like that? Or make sure, one hand, make sure your baby's sleeping with you in the bed. You know, that's like a practice that we do in Nigeria. That's fine. And then the nurse is telling me, don't do that. You can get, you know, sudden infant death. Make sure she's sleeping on this position in the cot and things like that. So all of those conflicting advice kind of confused me. So having that chat and having those other mothers who understood, you know, the blend and the cultural practices that we should pick up or drop, and, you know, just having that community, that support really, really helped. And so we had our first event/meetup. And there were so many mothers. It was in London, but people came from like Nottingham and Bristol and Coventry. And it was just nice being in a space where we saw so many mothers of color with their children and babies, and people cried, some people laughed. And that was, you know, my first time and many other mothers' first time really, really feeling included, really feeling seen, really feeling heard, and feeling like you had a supportive network or a village. You just got it without having to over explain, you know, why you wouldn't do certain things, just because we just got it. And that was in 2016. And that's how I started the motherhood group. So the motherhood group was a WhatsApp group that then turned into a social enterprise. So I've been doing that now for 7 years, running it, and I've got a team. We've got offices in Lambeth Town Hall, and we work with the NHS and deliver training programs, and we have workshops and peer support, and we run campaigns every year. We have Black Maternal Mental Health Week UK, and we launched the first ever Black Maternal Health Conference that's now been, you know, spoken about in the House of Parliament. So a lot's happened in those 7 years. That first started off as, you know, me being really frustrated, really angry, and quite lonely as well, to actually creating a movement and, you know, a safe space as well as a support hub for mothers who want care, who want support, but don't know really where to go or feel like services don't have those like culturally sensitive practices or support services as well.
And now a word from our sponsor, and happily, this next section of the podcast is brought to you by Clarks, for growing feet in safe hands. Now, you all know by now, I would hope, that we've been partnering very happily with Clarks this year. Love Clarks in our house. They're a brand that's had almost 200 years in perfecting their products, and they've taken these learnings into their first shoes offering. In fact, earlier this year, I took my youngest, Mickey, who's 4, for his first ever school shoes at Clarks, and he absolutely loved the experience. So we've already brought you the summer and the autumn special Clarks Culture Guide, and we are back for the final Christmas Clarks Culture Guide. So this is inspiration on exciting sensorial things to do with the kids up and down the UK as we lead into the festive period. I know what it's like. It's an exciting time of year, but you're also sometimes thinking, what can I do with the small people in my life over Christmas? So one idea is to go to a pantomime. Now, this might be well and truly part of your family tradition anyway. I know it is in our house. We always go to the pantomime. I've been going since I was small. And in fact, I've already taken my youngest with my mum. So they went with grandma and we had a lovely time. So if you look for family-friendly Christmas pantomimes, and in theatres in your area, the whole family can go. They're multi-generational. They're so much fun. There's often little interactive elements. Another thing you can do in your area is festive markets. These are becoming more and more common. I keep seeing them. So fun, they're free, they're beautiful, they're little Christmas markets. You get to wrap up warm, you get cozy, you can explore, you know, different smells like hot chocolates and nice candles, lights, sometimes even animals you get at these amazing markets. There's lots of things to experience, lots of things to look out. You can look in your nearest town from Edinburgh to Winchester. They are up and down the country from the end of November all the way through December. The other thing you can do, if the weather's looking a bit miserable, to go outside, why don't you host your very own kitchen disco? Yes, you can have a festive one. You do not need much for this. In fact, all you really need is music. I recommend just making the lighting a little bit moody, because when you have all the overhead lights on all the time, it can make you feel a bit exposed sometimes. I've actually had parents say to me, I feel a bit silly dancing in front of my kids. Trust me, when you get the music playing, your kids are not going to be looking at you. They're going to be focusing on their own dance moves. This is actually a really fun thing. It can be a really good way to bond as a family. And also it really shakes up any stress, any tension. It sort of flips the script, gets everybody smiling. And look, everybody can do this, from the youngest to the oldest member of the family. So yes, get your dancing shoes on. I would hotly, hotly recommend that tip. I want to thank Clark so much for partnering with Spinning Plates this year. I've loved doing these extra special Clark culture guides. So look, please let me know how you get on with your adventures. Share some pictures. If you do it on social with the hashtag Clark's Culture Guides, I will see them. Also, remember, Clark's in-store fitting service is available in all Clark's stores that sell kids' shoes. And each pair of shoes nurtures happy, healthy movement at every stage of your child's walking development and beyond. I can testify to that firsthand. You can shop Clark's first shoe collection now, or book an appointment for an in-store fitting at clarks.com.
clarksonshop.com. And from Clarks and everybody here at Spinning Plates, I want to wish you a very happy Christmas.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, firstly, I think what you've achieved is incredible, and it's making me smile hearing you talk about it, because I love the idea of the power of creating around you something that's empowered you to have that voice and go back into you of the past and basically say, don't worry, in the future, I will give you the voice you are struggling to find right now. That's really beautiful and so impressive, because when you were talking just then about even something as subtle and small as the fact that you might talk to a healthcare provider who has no idea about your heritage and the things that your mother's passing to you as the things coming down the generations, about giving the water to the baby and about co-sleeping, that when they get dismissed in an office, they're not just saying to you, it's not just, it's like showing absolutely zero understanding of anything about what all the parts that have made you, you. We all are the sum of our upbringing, and the advice of our family is a place we turn to again and again. So being sat there, feeling like you're about to enter into this new world, I'm a new mom, I don't know what my baby needs, I don't understand what every cry needs, my mum's giving me this advice, oh no, don't listen to your mum, she doesn't know what she's talking about either. That's actually incredibly dismissive, but also so, it's so sort of slack-handed in terms of actually trying to support a new mum to not understand what you might be hearing from your community, from your family members that are really well-intended, never mind what the statistics are around them. It literally, it comes from a place of love, and you don't want someone just to dismiss it as if it's just like a bit of dodgy advice you got from someone at a bus stop. You know what I mean? It's like, it's part of like your, it might be how you were raised. It might be what your sister's currently doing with her kids or something. You know what I mean? It's a bigger issue than that. So I think it'd be great to hear. And I know some of the statistics surrounding Black motherhood. You know, it's just things such as the fact that Black women are 4 times more likely to die in the sort of later stages of pregnancy, birth, and in the sort of 6 to 8 weeks afterwards as well. That's in the UK. That's a shocking statistic. So I guess when you're first setting up this group, how much of a big picture are you seeing? How much of it are you thinking of it as something that's got a race element, or is it more just feeling very personal to you at that time?
Yeah, so it's funny because, well, it's not really funny actually, but it's interesting because when I was going through my labour experience and the midwife was really cold towards me and was ignoring me and rolling her eyes every time I cried or screamed.
Wow.
That's literally what happened.
Rolling her eyes.
Rolling her eyes and saying, oh, come on, you're not even having the contractions yet. And I'm telling her, oh, I feel it. And then the anaesthetist coming in and saying, I'm not going to administer any epidural or any pain relief until you stop crying, because I was crying. And she said, she's not going to give me any. Whoa. And she actually left the room. She walked out and she shut the door and left me there. And I cried. And then I had to pick up myself and hold firm in my tears, wipe my tears, firm in my cries. And then she came back in about an hour later to then give me the epidural. My crying, my over vulnerability irritated her. And so I knew that my race had a lot to do with my treatment. I actually said it. I said, you're treating, like, quote unquote verbatim, you're treating me this way because I'm Black. And they didn't address it. They didn't say, oh no, we're not. They just ignored that. that comment. But I knew it. I didn't know the data. I didn't know the stats. I was not involved in this work at all. My experience has literally shaped the work that I do today. But I knew that was the reason. And I told my husband that's why they treated me that way. When my daughter sadly passed meconium stall on the way out and her heart rate dropped and it was really traumatic. And they finally did believe me when I said her head was crowning. The midwife then started asking me a few questions that weren't really related to my pregnancy or my birth. So things like, oh, so Sandra, you know, what do you do for a living? And, oh, okay, you know, where would you work? And all those questions. And I started to tell her. Then I could see her body language. It shifted and it changed. And so I immediately knew that she had stereotyped me. Wow. I don't even want to list off the stereotypes that are associated with you know, Black women, but I knew that she had changed her opinion of me in that moment. And then she gave me a new room, a nice room where I was by myself. She offered tea and coffee and toast and was really, really lovely. But it was far too late. I really wish that I had that, just even if it was a fraction of that treatment prior to those that interaction. Being nice, looking me in the eye, apologizing if I was, you know, if I felt a type of way, reassuring me, being empathetic, showing me kindness. In a report that I was involved in by Birthrights Inquiry that I co-chaired, Black women said that we felt we were the least likely to be on the receiving end of kindness. And that, you know, rings so true to me, because kindness, it's really hard to, I guess, measure, but you know when you haven't been on the receiving end of kindness and empathy, and it's really hard to explain, but you know it. And then she was really lovely to me, and then that was that incident. But then after kind of setting up the group and hearing, okay, one or two, and then three, four, 10, 20, loads of accounts of experiences that were too similar to mine, that echoed my experience and worse. Some other mothers, you know, weren't fortunate enough even to carry their babies home, you know, based on a lot of the, you know, the being ignored and dismissed and their symptoms not being picked up. And, you know, their experiences really made me really, really horrified and sad to know that I was lucky enough to still carry my babies home, even though my second daughter was really ill, and I did raise concerns and that was dismissed as well. There's still a legal case going on, but the trust did admit to a breach of duty, picking up her symptoms and not attending to her needs, despite me raising my concerns four times on different occasions. So yeah, I didn't know the data, I didn't know the stats, but doing the work, speaking to people, my experiences, and then the big report that came out in 2018 by Marion Knight, who is fantastic, the Embrace report that showed that Black women were five times more likely to die and have complications. Now we're, you know, 4 to 3.7 times more likely to have these complications. And then there's a whole other heap of other issues that we have. We're more likely to have depression. We're more likely to have neonatal deaths, stillbirths, miscarriages, hypertension. It's just, the list goes on, but these aren't really standalone events, Sophie. They all interlink, and it really boils down to us not being listened to, and not, you know, and also us not trusting the system. We're fearful. Many of us are fearful of it. We have our guards up. We're hyper aware. Even now, I'm pregnant with my third child, and I know there's a lot that has changed and kind of has slightly improved, but I think it's also because of the amount of awareness raising that has gone on that's made us know how to be a lot more vocal, a lot more, you know how to advocate for ourselves. And also we know how to pick up our own symptoms now. So that's probably why there's been a shift in the data. But I am very hyper aware, and I shouldn't have to be. I should be able to kind of relax and trust that those in this space or this sector, you know, have my best interest at heart and will do their jobs. So yeah, that's a bit of background into, you know, why it started and how I found out about this work, about the data, sorry, and the statistics surrounding Black maternal health and Black maternal mental health. But I'm just really glad that at the very least, there are people now are talking about it, people that had no idea, people that worked with, supported, you know, Black mothers, pregnant people, had no idea about this data. And that's scary as well, to know that they're speaking to and they're supporting Black women, but they have no idea actually that the woman you're engaging with has a five times more chance of not leaving this hospital with her baby. Yeah. And that should be something that everybody knows, especially if you are working in the maternity care system or the ward. And that's why part of the work that my organisation does, we train. So we've got commissioned by quite a few NHS trusts to, you know, deliver training services on, you know, making sure that they understand, you know, the key barriers, the cultural differences, and also how to provide that safe cultural care towards Black birthing people so that we have, you know, really good outcomes and experiences tailoring care to our specific needs and during the maternity period as well. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think there's so much to think about there. I think, firstly, I think it's amazing what you're doing, but I also feel like, why is it taken until you, you know? That's so recent, Sandra. You know, this should be like maybe something that, I don't know, your mum or someone not much younger than your mum started the ball rolling on very vocally. It's unnerving that it takes a kind of zeitgeist moment for people to actually start having the right kind of conversations. But then I guess, you know, you're on the receiving end of a lot of things. I mean, the UK has the biggest health pay gap in the whole of Europe. So the funding that goes into, illnesses pertaining to men is given so much more funding than anything pertaining to women. So we've already, that's where we're starting in the UK anyway. You know, little things I hadn't really thought of until I was reading your book properly about the fact that every time I've read a biology book, every time I've sat in a doctor's waiting room, most of the images on the posters or the, you know, the anatomical models will be on white bodies. So that already you're one, that's leaving you outside the door as well. You know, that how's that meant to make you feel? And the fact that you talk about something as simple and essential as kindness. I mean, kindness in childbirth is nurture. That's actually the memories you take away. You know they're doing amazing medical care in your peripheral vision, but the experience you remember is the exchanges you have with people because we're the patient. So it's, you know, it's the handhold, it's the kind words, it's the tenderness, it's the softly spoken bits. That's what you take away in those moments, and that's what bolsters you or can make you feel like, I'm freaked out. I don't like that woman being in the room while I'm having a baby. And, you know, you shouldn't have been even being able to be aware of your midwife having a shift in how she's dealing with you while you're also in labor. Imagine your brain having to think about all of that. Oh, she's treating me differently now. Oh, she's asking me about my profession. It's so naked. It's like, I'm sort of embarrassed for her in a way. And I'm glad you got your tea and toast, but we can kind of see the cogs working, right? It's shocking. And so, okay, we've got you feeling vulnerable and, you know, a little bit alone and lost in it all. You've got the WhatsApp group. You've got the snowball. Oh, golly, there's loads of other people out there. It resonates with them too. I recognise that story. Oh, wow, it happened to them. Okay, hang on a minute. What is really happening here? So at what point do you take it from a WhatsApp group, a community, a load of lovely people you feel safe with, and turn it into something that's got a little bit more drive in it? Where do you get from there to like this organization you have now?
Yeah, it was definitely a gradual process. It didn't happen overnight. And it was a WhatsApp group. And then we had our first meetup event maybe 3 months after chatting. And then I think after the first meetup, and there was so many mums that came into that building to the point where the venue manager was annoyed because there were so many buggies inside blocking the hallway outside, and he wasn't really aware that there'll be that many children, and he just thought it was like a little cafe sort of coffee morning, but it wasn't. It was a full-blown packed space, and I could see, oh my God, goodness, there's a need. When I could see that there was a need, a genuine need, a hunger for the space, I said, okay, we have to do another one. And it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But again, at the time, a lot of the conversations were very much focused on our overall well-being, being mothers, adjusting to life. Definitely we touched on the discrimination and health inequalities that we face in maternity care and postnatally. But we also incorporated other things like just relation, just how we can relate to our partners, our friends, and our community as well. So it was very much non-clinical, and more so community-based. And that's probably how we kind of appealed to the wider community. And then after the, so that happened for about two, three years. After the Embrace report and the Black Lives Matter movement, that's when we started getting a lot more traction from the healthcare sector. Bearing in mind, I had approached quite a few organizations beforehand to say, listen, these are the mothers we're speaking to. They're saying this. Many mothers are struggling with postnatal depression, and very, like, basically none are going to get any professional support. We're having to bring in, you know, midwives and doctors and nurses that happen to be Black mothers as well, and bring them into the space to actually say, you know, these are the practical steps that you could heal yourself. You can get support. Many mothers turn to more holistic care practices. So meditation and eating better and going to their church and finding, you know, community. And they stayed away from clinical settings. And so after the George Floyd incident, that obviously was horrifying, but it struck the world on an international and national basis. That's when I saw a massive shift in the way that everyone spoke about the role that race and racism plays a part in every system.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of my friends know this, and they were saying, Sandra, you're crazy. Why are you speaking so openly, you know, about Blackness and being Black? Like, aren't you afraid of not getting a job again? Aren't you afraid of being seen as this overly pro-Black person? And that's not the kind of person that they saw me as, this sort of, you know, massive campaigner. But I knew that. I was just like, wait a minute, there's an issue. There was nobody's really speaking about it as much. This is 7-8 years ago, and if they are, it's probably behind closed doors or amongst ourselves, and I'm not really seeing mainstream you know, campaigns around this. What's happening? And I had to be true to myself, especially because I was writing letters of complaints to my trust to say, hey, I had a horrible experience. This happened. Hey, this nurse did that to me and said that to me, and she shouldn't have. And now, you know, my child is sick because I raised concerns and you guys told me that I was over worrying. And actually now this data backs up that my feelings weren't incorrect.
Yeah.
It wasn't all in my head. I wasn't being a hysterical Black woman who just wanted to cause a bit of drama. I had validity in what I was saying and how I was feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I have things to back me up now. And so I think the shift was when, after the George Floyd, and then Birthrights approached me and asked me to be involved in their national inquiry, which was, I can't remember the year now, but forgive me, probably about three years ago. So up until that point, we had been, you know, working as a community organization, supporting the community and definitely raising awareness, but mainly feeding ourselves to kind of equip ourselves on how to, you know, manage and balance motherhood. But the communication between us, the healthcare sector, and also Parliament, government, was disconnected. They wasn't really involving us in their conversation, and we wasn't really involving them. But I think that inquiry and the national inquiry into racial injustice really broke that barrier, and it made sure that the community and everybody was speaking to each other. So I co-chaired that, and that's when it kind of went viral all over the news and newspapers, as well as the campaigners, Five Times More, who did their report and their petition as well. And people started speaking a lot more about it. A lot more groups started popping up, speaking about the same issue. So it wasn't just me and a few others anymore. It was quite a few people. And we had backing from, you know, people like MP Bell and, you know, Dr. Karen Joas and other quite prominent people in the space who were also taking a stand. And that's probably when I think it became less of a, be careful, don't talk too loudly about race and the role of racism, to more so an agenda that everybody has now as a priority: health inequalities in Black maternal care. And that's where I can see the natural shift. So from then till now, then we've had like quite a few projects with, you know, for example, Guy's and St. Thomas Hospital have commissioned us over the next 3 years to, you know, really continue the work that we've been doing. And that's through the Impact on Urban Health Fund. And we've been able to have now community space in Lambeth Town Hall, you know, where we have many Black mothers coming into our physical space to use it, to take part in research and projects that can really allow us to have our voices heard, have our voices amplified, get involved, say, okay, we now have power to make change. Yeah. You know, we no longer are being spoken to and about. We're now getting involved, so that the care is mapped out based on what we would like and what we think is acceptable and safe and practical and makes sense to us. And I'm really glad to see that massive shift, because based on that inquiry that I was involved in 3 years ago, over the last three years, you can hear mothers saying in their experiences that they felt unsafe, they felt dehumanized, they felt like they didn't have any consent or choice in how or where they gave birth. They were coerced. For example, myself, even I was induced without even knowing my first daughter. It sounds very strange, but if no one's telling you this is what I'm going to do, this is why I'm doing it,
yeah,
you're not really given the, you know, clarity in the process. And so they just say, I'm going to just check you, and then end up giving you a membrane sweep, which then triggers your waters to break. That's not giving consent for induction, you know. And we found that many mothers from my community had similar things done to them without being fully explained and feeling like they didn't really have a choice as well.
That's shocking, isn't it? What a violation.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is.
It's a basic. And also, how are you supposed to have trust, again, if someone says, I'm just going to check you? Anyone else saying that again is going to remember this time. Well, I had someone say that to me, and then, oh, my goodness.
Nope.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose what all of this need, I suppose, that is, you know, you were saying yourself, the statistics have been there, you know, it's been on the table a few times over. But it must have needed someone like you who can speak about it with passion, with the information right at your fingertips, but also a lived experience. That combination is pretty, it's powerful. You know, it has all the points of the triangle there. But I wonder, were you someone that was always able to advocate and speak like this before you found this need and this drive with what you're doing?
Yeah, I think, thank you for that, by the way, Sophia. I think a level of me just had to not care. So I've always kind of been a person that if I felt like I was being taken advantage of, that there was some sort of injustice, I had to be the one to speak up. And I think as time went on, naturally, I was conscious about not being perceived as, okay, over, it's Sandra again. Here we go. She's gonna raise her concerns. And so naturally, I think I was that kind of person. But also, when I truly believe that there is a problem and there's an issue and I'm being silenced, I will give it enough chance to see, okay, maybe they're doing it by accident. Maybe it's not malicious. Maybe there's another, you know, there's a motive behind why they're not really addressing this issue. But after a while, when you see actually it is to do with, you know, race or other factors that somebody just cannot help, then I will speak up. And that's what happened. I know Black women, my friends, they were so scared for me. Sandra, make sure you have to involve, you know, non-Black mothers too. Try your best to involve white mothers, because they won't listen to you if it's just us. And I kept saying to them, no, but that's not, that's, I know we all have challenges, but this issue right
here. Yeah, this is mine. I own this one.
Yeah.
And you don't need to dilute it it's powerful, because it's got the intensity of what actually needs to be sorted. And I suppose for you, sometimes it must be hard. Also, people must come to you with all sorts of experiences, and you've got to try and filter that. Like, thank you for sharing your experience with me, but also it's a lot for you to have on your shoulders when people at their most, I mean, you know, it's a traumatic experience they've had, and then they bring it to you and you're like, oh, that's another one. And also you had another baby during all this time, which is another thing that's just working out. So if your current youngest, I think is just 1 year older than my youngest. So was she, must have been, 2018, I think. Is
that right? 2018, correct.
So you said that's around the time that the Embrace report came out and all this. So I think
came out.
So you must have had a lot you were dealing with around your pregnancy then too, and your new motherhood again, part two.
Yeah, I think between the first and second pregnancy, you know, they were almost identical, even though a year and a half apart. But I've had a gap now. So my youngest is five. She'll be turning six in January. And so being in the space, working, sitting on panels and tables and knowing really that they are trying to lower these disparities and these challenges that Black mothers are facing in pregnancy and beyond. But now being pregnant now, I think for me, this has been probably the best kind of time for me to really analyze what has changed and what hasn't changed. What are the main issues? And even though I can still see the stats have lowered, the interactions still very much feel not based on genuine, I want to be kind, I want to be caring, I want to ask questions because I want to know more about this mother and help her. Sometimes it does feel a little bit like, oh no, I know about this campaign that's going on or the work that's going on in this space. She's a Black woman. I have to tick this box and that box. Otherwise, I could get in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't look good for me. People, and I even don't even want people to know sometimes I'm the person behind a lot of this work because I don't want their treatment to be shifted based on not wanting to actually really help me, but based on fear. And so that punitive sort of punishment element has come into it, which some might say it's still good, Sandra. It's better for them to treat you better based on fear than to treat you bad. But actually, I just want it to be a human instinct. Like, how would you treat your cousin, your auntie, your sister? Would you treat them in a loving and kind and caring manner with empathy on the receiving end of kindness and choice and explaining options to her? If so, just treat somebody else, a new mother, in the same way as well. It doesn't seem hard, but sadly, you'd be surprised. People just don't have that level of patience and care. And that's why I say, if you really want to be a nurse or a midwife or work in the health sector, you have to have a passion for wanting to help people. You have to have passion to genuinely wanting to care. And you have to address your own bias. We all have biases. I mean, human nature is for us to look at something and make a judgment. Now, it gets very dangerous if somebody's, you know, life is in your hands and you have harmful preconceived notions about that person's culture, values, religions, age, and then treat them differently based on that. I was on a podcast a few years ago, Sophie, and I was quite surprised for one of the chief midwives to say, the head midwife to say that her team they don't have anyone racist. I'm so sorry, Sandra. I don't know why, you know, I'm sure the data isn't wrong, but she never sees people in her hospital treat anybody Black with ill-mannered. And then she gave an example that one time, or she gets frustrated with hearing somebody on the phone who is working with customers that has a very strong Asian accent, for example. She gets very irritated and frustrated, and she wants them to be, she was quite honest, and I appreciated that. But then I kind of raised the concern, said to her, okay, now imagine that person giving birth and you're getting frustrated at their accent. That's going to tailor or alter the way that you treat that person, whether you realize it or not. Mm-hmm. And that could be the difference between you being more patient, more softly spoken, giving her more options, listening to her concerns and maybe taking them on board, maybe even being more proactive in some of the remedies than versus being more short, sharp, quick, irritated. When I was crying during the epidural and they said, I'm not going to give it to you until you stop crying and left the room, I wondered if I was a white lady, maybe she would have been like, I'm so sorry you're crying. Should I wait a few minutes? Maybe should I come back? What do you need? I didn't get that. And I know it's because she didn't feel like she had the patience for me specifically. And again, many, many mothers from my community, we feel we have to have our CVs on our shoulders before we are on the receiving end of this treatment. And it's sad because I know after the question she asked me, what do you do for a living? Where do you live? What, you know, my husband wasn't my baby daddy. He was my husband. That's what probably she assumed. That's when the treatment and her tone changed and her body language changed. But why do we have to? Everybody deserves to be on the receiving end, regardless of your age, your sex, your background, whether you're married or not, whether you live here or there. It doesn't matter. And that's right. What I think needs to change is that human, add a humanistic, just just be a nice person.
I think that would help the world turn a lot smoothly, like in all walks of life, by the way. But also I do kind of feel like your midwife now, wherever you're seeing when you go for your appointments, must be like, I've been like, here we go. It would have been quite spectacular for that midwife if she'd said, what do you do? And you'd gone, actually, I run an organisation. I'm CEO of an organisation looking into disparities and how black mothers are treated in childbirth and aftercare. Oh. She would have been like, okay.
Man, I know.
Yeah. But you're right, and I suppose my heart goes out to you in those experiences, but just anybody that, look, I've got so many birth stories in my head from my girlfriends, and anyone that experiences, you know, that tactless comment from the healthcare professional, you always remember it, you never forget it, but to have it as a... to have the association that it might have come at you because of a judgment made of the colour of your skin is... unacceptable. Even if it only happens once, that's not acceptable, let alone for it to be part of how our system is set up at the moment. So what you're doing is brilliant work. When you're having your baby, do you feel like, okay, I'm going to need to shift the mantle a bit, or are you so like pumped up for keeping doing what you're doing? You've got plans. I mean, I get the impression you're going to have lots of things in your head. I don't see you slowing down, but yeah.
I can't slow down. So you help. I don't want to slow down. I feel like a lot has changed since myself and others have been involved in this work. There's a lot more that needs to be done. There's a lot of work going on behind the scenes that I know, you know, will come into fruition later on. It takes time. It's not going to happen overnight, sadly. But I think even just having my baby and going through it again has helped me refresh my memory of the gaps that's needed to be bridged, the areas where services need to understand some of the barriers. And then also I think there needs to be an involvement also. Now the healthcare sector, we understand for the most part, other sectors need to know, because mothers go back into work, financial services, working in education and other sectors. Again, if you're a black mother and you're more likely to have depression and the least likely to get support, and you're more likely to struggle with baby loss, miscarriages, hypertension, I think HR needs to know this. I need to know how to support you on that. And so I guess for me, the next space is really infiltrating other sectors and other organizations that also interact and support all mothers, but specifically black ethnic minority mothers as well. The support is needed on a grand scale, and also preconception before becoming a mother. You need to know all of the data that not to give you anxiety and make you scared, but to know how to prepare yourself as well, what's to come and also what you're facing, because again, as you mentioned earlier on, I don't know why it's taken this long for some sort of change to happen or some sort of attention to happen. If our parents were more likely to die and have complications, and our grandparents, and it's always been this way. Why now?
But I guess, you know, you'll be able to see your work very close to home with your own daughters as they grow up, and the conversation. I suppose you must feel a little bit like, you know, by pulling at the thread of your experience in your first pregnancy and first childbirth, it must have like pulled and pulled until this whole appears of like all the areas that need help, all the bits that need darning, all the bridges that need to be built. But I mean, how powerful that for your daughters and that generation, they will be in a different version of the UK actually, because of the work you're doing. I mean, do you feel a bit like what's happened from that experience has actually given you I hate talking about it, like, I don't know, is it legacy or your purpose, I suppose? It must be your purpose, I think, is probably more appropriate words.
110%. It's definitely given me, it's part of my purpose. I always say I've turned my pain into my purpose, and it sounds very cheesy and cliche, but it's the truth. The pain that I experienced, you know, giving birth and subsequently after, I couldn't even speak about my experiences without crying. I'd always burst into tears. Felt really like, I just felt that it wasn't fair. Like, it's just, this is just not fair. Injustice. And so I guess, you know, being quite open at the time where there was a heavy taboo around birthing experiences, perinatal mental health, speaking about race and racism, and then just seeing a lot more people speaking up. So just a catalyst effect of just people being more honest, using social media, other platforms to speak about experiences relating to what I've just mentioned. And then now knowing that my daughters will definitely have a different experience. They have to, because, you know, I'm hoping by the time they get to, you know, childbearing age, that they will be a lot more confident in themselves. And also services are a lot more aware of the disparities, and they're willing to put in procedures in place to support them. You know, changing policies is a big thing for us. And now they're setting targets to address disparities for Black maternal health care in the UK. And remember, this is not just a national thing. This issue obviously is in America as well. Yes. So it's not just a British thing. It's an international thing. Yeah. And in some states, it's even like some Black women are like 7 times more likely to die. And it's also not a socio-economical thing as well, because you have people like Serena Williams and Beyonce who are extremely successful, who are Black, who have had similar experiences to other Black women who come from very different backgrounds. So we have to be honest and say race is a factor. It's not the only factor, but it's definitely the main challenge that we need to address. So just being able to speak about it, you know, for example, you giving me a platform to speak about this is just amazing, you know, to know that people care and people are listening.
Definitely.
And that's for me important.
Oh, it's vital. And also I was thinking, well, you said like your daughters also will have something that you didn't have as much of, which is the ability to be vulnerable and let you know when things are hard for them, which is an amazing tool. I do think that's something that's a more recent thing for how we're raising people now. We have much more focus on that ability to be open and, you know, model failure, model weakness, all these things as parents we're encouraged to. And I suppose, you know, they won't quite understand the massive significance of what you're doing right now, because I'm sure they're not thinking at all about what it feels like to be pregnant or have a baby or anything like that. But when they get there, they're going to be like, wow. And they're going to feel like, this is actually kind of cool. We helped spark this change. That's exciting, isn't it?
I haven't thought of it in that way, that they probably will think that actually when they're old enough that, their birth, them coming into the world, helped spark this change. Yeah,
absolutely. And there'll be the chronology as well of how long you've been part of this new chapter, which is cool. And I wish you all the best with everything that happens with baby number 3.
Thank you.
Wish you a very peaceful, happy childbirth and beyond. Yes. I was thinking, I don't know what gender you're having, but you were saying like Chloe and Zoe and Sophie, you could kind of fit in with that, you know.
Zoe, Chloe, Sophie.
There you go.
Not too bad, you know. Yeah, is your name a French name by any chance?
It is French. So, well, I mean, that's where the derivation is. And it comes, I was always told this when I was little. So the Soph part comes from like sophisticated Sophocles, the Greek for wisdom. So, you know, comes with it, some fancy stuff. You don't always have to live up to it, but that's where it comes from.
Thank you. No, I will update you on the name when I find out and release the sex to the world. But definitely we'll put Sophie in the list of
put it in the
names.
Perfect.
Yeah, put it in the hat.
Exciting. New babies, new chapters. It's always a good thing. Thank you so much, Sandra. What a brilliant chat. I can't wait to see what happens for you next. I'm going to be watching for sure.
See? What a woman.
All good.
I think that's, it's just exciting when someone has a life experience and it actually makes them sort of find their purpose. I think purpose is such a thing. I never really used to think about it when I was younger. I never used to think about legacy and I never used to think about purpose. But a lot of these conversations have really encouraged me to think a little bit more about it. And I do think a lot of it is just about leaving the world a little bit better than you found it. Even if it's only everyday kindnesses, it doesn't have to be big, bold strokes. However, if you are passionate about making change and you do feel that call to action, then how amazing. We need lots of that in the world, don't we? And yes, meanwhile, what is my legacy? Well, at the moment, it's hopefully making a few people feel a bit better about this Christmas that's coming our way. That'd be nice. It's not a bad start. And I've got a day off tomorrow at home and I'm really looking forward to it. It's been amazing to do this tour, but it's always quite tricky doing the juggle of home and away. And I have a brilliant support network of people helping with the kids. But that being said, I've got 1 week to go and then it's just pure togetherness all the way until January. And I'm really, really looking forward to that. Just kind of, I think it's been a joy to do this tour knowing that after I can just actually just go, right, pass me some mulled wine and some devils on horseback and let's have Christmas. And I was a bit worried I'd be Christmased out, but I'm not. I'm still here for it. Let's keep going. When I get home, I've got to finish decorating my tree. We put it up on Monday. I did a fair amount, actually. It's looking decent, but it needs a bit more decoration. And I don't know how you are with your decorations and your tree. I am definitely, it's not just maximalism. It's also just, I quite like a slightly scattergun thing. So I just keep chucking loads of decorations and standing back and having a look. But I want it to look like bountiful and loads of colour and fun. I'll take a picture and post it so you can have a look, see what you reckon. But I do like it all. And we get all the same decorations out. And I've actually only bought one new decoration this year. I used to allow myself a couple every year. But this year I just found, when we got our tree, the place where we got the tree had loads of decorations. And one of them was a sparkly ketchup bottle. So I got that. So that's on my tree now. And of course we've had the obvious thing where you open up the box and then you smash a couple of old baubles. But all my favourites are intact. So this bodes well. It's a good omen. Anyway, if you're coming to one of the shows, the remaining shows, where we've got left, I'm thinking when this goes out on Monday, I'll only have Cardiff and Bristol and Birmingham. So if I'll see you there, thank you so much. Can't wait. If you've already been, thank you so much. If you're just here for the podcast guest, thank you so much. Basically, whatever brings you my way. Thank you. And I will speak to you next week. All right. See you in a bit. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for ways to win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.